everybody here. Please be welcome to this fantastic kid here. I learned a lot from him, even though he's only since 2 years playing around with iOS. I mentioned as well the first untethering case that I had with my iPhone was something like with iOS 5.1. And with every update, you had to do the whole shebang again, of course. That's what I remember. So please give a warm welcome here to little Lilo. I spell this correctly?
Yeah.
Yes. Little Lilo is really a very fascinating geek. He actually hacks any kind of OS device, to my opinion. Any kind of, huh?
Yeah.
So throw it to him and it comes back in pieces. He's as sharp as a knife. Please give him a warm welcoming applause. We're going to untether iOS. Yay.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm Lilo, as already introduced. I'm interested in IT security in general, and I started to look into iOS about 2 years ago. And then I met three awesome guys, Siguza, Stack, and Ivy Sparks, and we basically started to chat a lot, and in the end also released the jailbreak me for iOS 10, on Toil and not spyware.lol. So for everybody who isn't familiar with the jailbreak scene, it's like rooting on Android, so it basically is a tool that gives the user the capability to tweak their device, and that's mostly done by basically installing a jailbreak. In this case, you just go to a website and then slide there, and it will install a package manager on your phone, and then the end user can install tweaks, so just little dynamic libraries, and they get injected into all the other system processes, and then they can obviously modify their memory, and that, for example, allows customization of the home screen or something like that. And basically, with the release, we also formed the team, the Jailbreak for 20 team. And it was created, and with that, a Twitter account, and there are also a few demos there if you want to check it out after the talk. And yeah, I basically had this pipe dream that in my life I really want to achieve an untethered jailbreak using only some sort of plist or other save file corruptions. So basically, there are different kinds of jailbreaks. In modern jailbreaking, the most common kind are semi-untethered, which means that the user has to connect their device to a PC when they first install the jailbreak, and then they sideload an app onto the device, so it just installs itself there. And then on each reboot, the user has to go into the app and press a button to jailbreak the phone. And basically, after they reboot, they lose the jailbreak and have to go through this process again. And with an untethered jailbreak, the jailbreak gains persistence on installation, and then they will automatically jailbreak the device on each boot. So the device already jailbreaks, boots jailbroke. So yeah, the untethered can be divided into four stages. In the first stage, that's the config file or database stage, I will go over how we gain execution after boot. Then the config parser bug that gives us the write-to-wear primitive. And then I will talk about the main bug, the ASLR bypass, which allows us to get into ROP. Then stage two is basically a kernel exploit and completely written in ROP. And there I will go over the two main kernel bugs, so the KSLR leak and then the RACI-3 we use to get kernel read-write. And I will also talk about the KSLR weakness and the root domain user client memory leak, which aided us in exploitation. And after we get kernel read-write, we can remove a few restrictions from Apple. Mainly, we can bypass code signing, and that gives us the ability to load an unsigned dynamic library into our process. So now in stage three, we are basically in C via a dynamic library. And there we are stashing the kernel task port to host special port 4. So iOS has this concept of ports, task ports. And basically, if you have a send write to a task port of a process, you can read and write its memory. They are most used for inter-process communication, basically. And where modern jailbreaks usually stash the kernel task port into host special port 4, so that other user mode applications can then retrieve it, and with that retrieve the send write, and then they can just read and write process memory. And after that, I just fix up everything, and then spawn stage 4, and that's basically running in a separate process that has a few advantages I will go into later, and it's basically performing the whole post-exploitation process, including launching substrate, the framework that's used for tweak injection, and then performing LU restart to restart all the launch daemons on the system and inject the tweaks into them. So yeah, in stage one, we basically need to get execution after boot, and when iOS boots, launchd is the first process that's running on the system, and it basically then loads a dynamic library with a list of executables that are launch daemons, and there are a few flags associated with them, and if the run and load flag is set, launchd will then spawn all of those launch daemons afterwards. And we basically just attack one of those launch daemons, namely Raccoon. So what is Raccoon? Basically, Raccoon is part of the IPsec package, and it's a VPN client used to interact with an IPsec VPN server. And the problem is, though, that the IPsec tools project has been abandoned since 2014, so they officially here state on their website that the development of the project has been abandoned, and that IPsec tools has security issues and you should not use it. Apple still decided it was a good idea to ship it after 2014, and they now maintain their own fork on opensource.apple.com. And yeah, basically the only thing that's important for the talk is that Raccoon has a configuration parser. So on startup, it will just look for a file on disk and start to parse that. And that's written in YAG, so completely written in C. So memory corruption might become a problem, and it actually is a problem, as we can see with the config parser bug. And for that one, we have to go back a bit. Basically, in 2011, Poch2G released Corona for iOS 5, which was also an untethered. And there he used a bug in Raccoon in the configuration parser, and Poch2G found this one on an old bug tracker, and basically the IPsec website had this bug tracker there where users could just report problems with their programs, and one user in 2009, I think, reported a bug that if he would use this specific config, Raccoon would just segfault, but nobody looked at this for 2 years, so in 2011, Poch2G realized that this was actually exploitable and then used in a jailbreak, and after that, obviously, Apple got aware of it, and then they also said that they fixed it, and it got a CVE, a signed CVE 2012-3727, and yeah, they say that the issue was improved through improved bounce checking, just through improved bounce checking. So let's look at the patch. That's the function before the patch, and that's the function after the patch. And if this was too fast for you, here's the diff. So basically, there is no difference. The bug is still there, and Apple didn't patch it. What really happened here was that basically this is obviously a configuration parser, so there are different statements that nearly do the same thing. There are these DNS4 statements to parse an IP address, and there are WINS4 statement followed by an IP address, and they, for both of them, they have to parse the IP address. So the function for copying that, for parsing that, was just copy-pasted from another one, and yeah, basically Apple fixed the bug in the other function. So which I don't get, because basically the engineer there had to look at it at the POC Poch2G provided. Then they had to realize, okay, the bug is in there, fix it, and then they had to recompile it and never test it against the original POC, because otherwise Raccoon would have crashed again. Yeah, it's basically an off by one, which allows you to overwrite the index of an array. And Poch2G gave a talk about this, and we can basically reuse his strategy from back in 2011 to get a write-aware primitive. So yeah, again, the vulnerable function. Here at the top, you can see the YAG syntax, so an address wins list has to consist of either an address wins statement or an address wins statement followed by a comma followed by an address wins list. So that's a recursion, there can be multiple address wins statements in a row. And then below that, an address wins statement is defined as containing an address string, and that's just a regex to match an IP version 4 address. And if the parser finds that, it will run the code between those two brackets. So they get a pointer to a global struct, and then they check if this NVNS4 index is bigger than maximum wins, and if so, they return an error. The problem here is that this is the off by one, it shouldn't be checking if it's greater than, so but it should be a check for greater or equal than max wins. And after that, they use this inotPython function to basically parse the address, which is in this variable, into the NVNS4 array at the NBNS4 index and then post increment the index, and that will also become in handy when exploiting this bug. So yeah, how is exploitation done? Basically, there are here the globals, there's this LC config pointer in the globals pointing to a heap structure that the parser also uses, and then there's this DNS4 array followed by the DNS array index, and then the NBNS4 array followed by the NBNS4 array index. So we can just use a modcfg statement followed by this wins4 statement with the IP address to parse the IP address in the first array element, and we can repeat this process four times to then move the index out of bounds. So now it's pointing to itself, and the cool thing is about that is that they thought it would be a good idea to use integers for those array indexes instead of unsigned integers. So we can just point them, you just use a negative number to bypass the bounds check. So yeah, we'll override it with minus one to point it to the DNS array index, and then we use another win statement to override the DNS array index with a negative number. And the cool thing about this is that because of the post incrementation, it will move it back to zero, so we can repeat this process as often times as we want. And we will use a negative number to basically point it to the LC config pointer, and then we can use two DNS4 statements to override the LC config pointer and point it anywhere in memory. And after that, we can use a timer statement with a counter, and the parser will just try to write it to the LC config structure, so it will dereference our point and write it there. And the interval statement will basically write to an uint32, which is followed by the uint where the counter statement is written. So we can turn this into a 64-bit write-what-where primitive and write anywhere in process memory. And that gives us then the ability to basically exploit the ASLR bypass. So this is the main bug of the whole untethered and allows us to basically have this primitive, and it's also the reason why I decided to give this talk this year, not last year, because there the bug was pretty fresh and only patched in iOS 12, and it gives an attacker the ability to exploit zero-click more easily because they just need a write-what-where primitive, and that's why I held back on it. SIGUSA found it after looking into Apple's patches of the Corona ASLR bypass, and basically from Poch2G's presentation, we as a team learned that ASLR is always bypassed when a writable region is larger than the maximum slide, because then there's always a writable address in process memory, and you can used this to brute force the slide, and SIGUSA found out that there was also the same problem with the cache in iOS 11 and a few versions of iOS 10 actually. So what's the cache? Basically, the cache is a pre-compiled blob containing all the dynamic linked libraries from Apple. So on each release, they just move all of those into one big file to optimize load times of apps and keep memory pressure low. So it's a pretty big file. And for that, on boot, the kernel needs to calculate a slide and slide it in memory. But they only slide it once on boot because it's used in every process. And so Apple defines an area of memory for the cache with a base address and a size, and that's hard-coded on iOS 11. The cache got so big that the maximum slide is now smaller than its data segment, so the condition here is satisfied and ASLR can be bypassed, basically. And the weird thing about this is that actually the same thing also happened in iOS 7. Back then, the size was defined as 500 megabytes and the cache got bigger than 500 megabytes. But before that, it was also in a few versions possible to have the same condition that the data segment again was bigger than the maximum slide. And Apple was actually also aware of this because Esser talked about it in one of his talks, but they just increased the maximum slide to 1 gigabyte and didn't add any asserts. And now in iOS 11, it again got so big that the same thing happened. And we believe that they didn't even really notice that up until iOS 12, where the cache was now bigger than 1 gigabyte, so the kernel just couldn't fit it in the memory region and panicked. And because of that, they just thought, well, then we will increase it to 4 gigabyte while developing. So we might see this reoccurring in, I don't know, iOS 15 or something like that. Exploitation is also pretty simple. We can just brute force the slide now, and there are a lot of function pointers in the data segment. So we decided to go with platform memmove because we can reach it via a strlcopy from the config parser. And the basic strategy behind this is we write a slit rob chain to an address we can always write to for a specific slide ABC. And then we overwrite the platform memmove pointer at its unslit address plus the slide we just chose with a gadget that would pivot to our slit rob chain. And then we call strl copy. And now there are basically two possibilities. Either we guess the right slide and then we jump to our gadget and pivot the stack, or we guess the wrong slide, but obviously nothing happened because we can just write there. So we can go back to step one and try again. And then with that, we can just brute force the slide till we got the right one. The catch with this, however, is that the write word pair is pretty slow and it also needs a lot of storage. For a 64-bit write, I need about 120 bytes in the config file. And because there are so many possible slide values, the chain I have currently is around, it's only two rob gadgets, but the config file is already 12 megabytes, I think. And because of that, it takes around 10 seconds to run if it's a really bad slide. So the rob chain has to be as short as possible. And the other problem is that if we have a bad slide, we will basically smash the whole data segment and we can't really recover from that. So we had crashes in malloc and stuff like that while developing, basically. There are some solutions to that. We can have a really short rob chain in stage one, and we can achieve this by basically just opening the big cache file to get a file descriptor to it, and then we can map it at a static address and then get many gadgets there because the file is obviously code signed by Apple, so we can just jump there after mapping it. But the problem with that is that nothing is set up, so malloc and other functions aren't working. But as I said earlier, the current cache has the smash data segment, so we don't really lose anything. And after having the cache at a static address, we can use the open and mmap functions from that cache to basically map stage 2 into the process memory, and stage 2 is just a really big rob stack. So, yeah. And then we are basically in rob, but we can only use raw syscalls and not much more, because everything else will either use a function that uses malloc or will use malloc on its own. And the other problem is that basically Erno is also broken, so every syscall which fails will crash the binary. So the first thing I do is basically map a few pages so that Erno works again, because we have a few syscalls that might fail. And then the other big problem is that we now need to implement a whole kernel exploit in rob. So I started to write a framework around this awesome gadget, which is present in all the cache versions I looked at. Basically, at the top, you can see that all the high registers are moved into X0 through X7. So all the registers used for the calling convention in ARM. And then we branch link register based on X27. So also high register, and after that we load all the register values back from the stack, so we can just chain those gadgets together to call any functions. We basically rob into the lower half and then chain another one of those afterwards, and then they can load all the values, call the function, and then load all the values from the stack again, and that's how the whole rob chain works. So yeah, I also used another gadget to basically add two registers together, and another one which stores X0 so that I can just store the return value on the stack and later reuse it. And for loops, I use a gadget which just returns if X0 is 0, so it's basically just a read instruction then, and otherwise it will tail call a function using a function pointer from the data segment. And because I can control the whole data segment, I can just put a function pointer there that will then jump to an epilogue and miss a line of stack with that. And then I can call long jump with two different register values, and because of that pivot the stack to another location. And when we basically didn't jump outside of the loop, I just mmap the part of stage 2, which has the loop in it, back over the old stack again, and then I can just reuse the stack every time. And then pivot up using long jump. The problem with this, however, is obviously that it's pretty slow because I used mmap as a syscall. But this can be solved by just unrolling your loops, like for 10 iterations, and then mmapping the file so that I get more loop iterations basically per second, which is important for the race. So Yeah, now we will go over the kernel bugs. So the KSLR leak is CVE 2018-4413 by PanicAll. It was fixed in iOS 12.1, and it's luckily reachable from the Raccoon sandbox because Apple is sandboxing most userland processes, and the Raccoon sandbox is really tight. We didn't have that many bugs that would work in Raccoon, but luckily this one does because Raccoon has access to the sysctl functions, and this one is in the sysctl procargsx function. The procargsx function basically allocates a page using kmalloc, but it doesn't zero it, so it might contain old heap data, and then they copy the process arguments to the front of the page. And now if you supply a wrong size from user space, and there are a few other conditions that have to be met, for some weird reason, it copies from the end of the page into user space, which I don't get why this even got through code review. But yeah, as a graphical illustration, there's basically this page and this full of uninitialized data, and then they put the process arguments in the front and copy out uninitialized heap data from the back into userland. And we can obviously just spray specific heap objects with kernel pointers in them and then free them again and use this primitive to maybe leak them. And if we find a kernel pointer in there, we can just calculate this kernel slide. So yeah, and then we come to the RACI double free. As I said, the main problem with the untether is the Raccoon sandbox. So many of the kernel bugs that would work in iOS 11 from an app didn't work from Raccoon. But luckily on Halloween, Sparky told me about the light speed bug from Synetic, which is reachable from the sandbox. It's a double free in Kellogg 16, so the kernel allocator is based on zones and with different sizes. So there's, for example, Kellogg 16, and then all objects in that zone have a size of 16 or less bytes, and there are obviously also other zones for bigger objects. And basically, there's this structure in there that then gets doubled. And so there's the syscall that's handling async file events, so a user mode application can just call it and tell the kernel, hey, please write that buffer to a file and then move on with execution. And it uses a kernel thread to perform those. And for that, it basically allocates a structure to contain some metadata, like where the buffer is and to which file it should write. And the kernel thread obviously has to free this structure after it's done, because it just gets encrypted into the query for the kernel thread, then that wakes up and maybe sees that it has a new job, then performs the operation, and then it has to free it, otherwise it would leak. But the problem here is that if an error occurred while setting the structure up, the second field in the structure will be zero, and then the structure also isn't encrypted into the jobs list, so the kernel thread will never wake up and look at it. So the syscall has to free it, because otherwise it will leak. And the problem here is that we can basically reallocate the structure before the syscall checks. So what happens here is that the syscall allocates the structure and fills it up, and then it gets added to the list. And then the kernel thread is so fast that it runs while the syscall code isn't finished yet, and basically gets the job done and frees it, and then we can spray heap objects pretty fast to overlay with that structure, and then the syscall finishes and checks the field and sees that it's zero, because we just replaced it with an object that has zero at that location, and so it frees it again, leading to a double free, and yeah, we can obviously exploit that. So for exploitation, I just spam the syscall in one thread, which is pretty hard to do in ROP, but I just call thread create with a pointer to long jump and then pivot the stack to that location. And then in the other thread, I spray mach messages with mach port null in it. And the thing with mach messages is basically they can be used to do inter-process communication, and you can also transfer port writes from one process to another. So in this case, we just send an empty port, but you could also place something else there, and that will create a structure in Kellogg 16 containing zero at that location. And then if the mach message gets freed, we can replace it with something and basically point it to somewhere in kernel where a fake port structure lives. And when we receive the mach message again, it will basically think that this is a real real port and treat it as such, and with that we can create a fake kernel task port. So yeah, but for that we obviously need to replace it, and we need a heap spray, and most commonly iOSurface is used for that as the kernel extension. But because of our sandbox, we are so limited that we don't have iOSurface access. So the question is how we actually spray, and their root domain user client comes to the rescue with a memory leak. So actually this function secure sleep system options is reachable from this Raccoon sandbox, and Apple has a way of basically parsing data to the kernel via XML. So a userland application can just pass the XML to the kernel, and then they will use this OS unserialized XML function to turn the XML back into C++ objects, which the kernel can then use. And if this sounds dangerous to you, it actually is. There were a few bugs in that. But in this case, we basically, this makes true with the OS dynamic cast that the data the user mode application supplied is an OS dictionary so that it can use it afterwards. And the problem here is that we can basically just supply an OS data object or an OS array. So this OS dynamic cast will fail and unserialized options will become null. But the original pointer returned from OS unserialized XML will get lost. And so we will leak that memory. And yeah, we can just use this for spraying. So then about those two primitives we use to aid basically exploitation, the case lar weakness, there are these CTL buffers and they are located in the kernel data region. And because of that, they are slit with the same slide as the kernel text region. And this means that as long as we know the kernel slide, and we already do that from the KSLR leak, and we can control the contents of a sysctl buffer, we can get data to a known address. And we can easily do that with Raccoon because it runs as root. And so we can just switch out the sysctl buffer and, for example, place the fake port structure there, or we later also place a fake trustcast structure there, but I will get into that. So yeah, now we can use the primitive to basically spray 10 OS data objects pointing to the sysctl buffer, and then we just receive the mach message again and check if the port is not null, and if that's the case, we basically replace the structure. And then for the non-SMAP version, we can even get the case like by traversing a few pointers, but that's not needed for the SMAP version because there we already got it with the KSLR leak. But yeah, on non-SMAP devices, we also don't need the sysctl buffers because we can just place the fake port structure in userland, and then we get the kernel slide this way. And with the kernel slide and this fake port, we can create a fake user client, and from there we can create a call primitive. And then we can use this to override the BSS trustcache pointer and point it to a buffer with two hashes for stage 3 and stage 4. So basically, Apple has two ways of doing code signing. Either it has a userland daemon that verifies third-party applications, or it has this so-called trustcache, which is a list of hashes from all of their system applications. And as soon as a process is spawned or a dynamically linked library is loaded, they will basically first verify if the hash of that file is inside of the trust cache, and if so, they would just trust the binary blindly because it comes from Apple, basically. And now when we override this trust cache point and point it to our buffer, we can basically place the hashes of stage 3 and 4 there, and then the system will think those are Apple binaries and we can just load them. So yeah, and for that we need to use the ghetto dlopen. We can't use the real dlopen because that uses malloc. So we just open stage 3 to get a file descriptor. Then we attach the signature, which now succeeds as the hash is in trust cache. And then we can map it as read, execute, and jump there. And then we are, after 2 months of writing drop chains, we are finally in C and we can write code more easily. And the problem there is that we still don't have a working cache, so we are still limited to the basic functionality, and because of the ghetto dlopen, linking is obviously not working. So we just rely on raw assembly for the syscalls, and I also pass some function pointers which I already used for stage 2. So for example, open and mmap to stage 3. From there, we remap the kernel task and stash it into our special port 4 so that other user mode applications can use it. And then we can basically escape the sandbox by zeroing the sandbox label in the process structure, so that we can launch a new binary, because otherwise the Raccoon sandbox doesn't allow it, but in the kernel, those process structures basically have this label, which tells the kernel which sandbox to use, and by zeroing it, you can just tell it to not use any sandbox, and then we can launch stage 3, 4, and with that get a working cache back, and that's the big advantage from like having a separate file. We now have the full cache functions working and can do work more easily. And then it's just a call to POSIX spawn and then a raw exit syscall to exit the daemon without crashing, because if launch D would see that one of the launch daemons crashed and the specific flag it set, it would try to restart it and then our ROP chain would run again. We obviously want to prevent that, so we use the exit syscall to exit it cleanly. And then we are in stage 4. And from my side, that was just basically to block all signals so we don't get killed by launch D, because when launch D sees that the launch daemon exits, it will send a sick kill to all its child process, and I need to catch that, otherwise stage 4 would get killed. And then I just called the post-exploitation framework, which was written by Sparky, and basically that does the following. It first elevates the process to root with kernel credentials, then it performs a remount of the root file system, because on stock iOS the root file system is mounted as read-only, and we obviously need to mount it as read-write to modify some files on there, and then it sets the nonce so that the user might be able to downgrade to an older version if they have blobs, verifies that the bootstrap is in place from the installation, and then injects substrate, so the framework that's used for to perform tweak injection and its plugin into the trustcast and starts them so that they can start to inject into newly spawned processes. Then it spawns all the launch daemons associated with the jailbreak, unloads our own daemons so that we don't respawn it by accident and run the kernel exploit again, and then performs an LD restart to basically restart all of the launch daemons of the system so that substrate can inject tweaks to them, and with that the system is fully jailbroken and we can perform a few cleanup steps, but yeah, basically the end user has a jailbroken system then. As a little side note, while we were testing all the daemons, we got killed by Jetsam a lot. So basically Jetsam is this kernel extension from Apple that is there for memory management, and they basically want to make sure that the user mode application doesn't use too much memory, because they don't have that much on an iPhone, on all the iPhones actually. So there is this list, and Jetsam, if Jetsam sees that the user and process uses more memory than it should use, it will just kill it. So we changed the values in the plist and the launch daemons to actually allow the launch daemons to use more memory. But the weird thing about this is that this actually got accepted by Jetsam and we had no more crashes, while Apple actually tried to mitigate that beforehand. So because jailbreakers always would modify those configuration files on the launch daemons, they started to move all of them into a dynamic library to guard them under code signing so that jailbreakers couldn't change them anymore. But when we tried to figure out the launch daemon, the launch order of daemons, we dumped that dirlib, and there was also a plist embedded for Jetsam, but Apple was still using those files on disk, so I really want to look further into this because it seems like Apple isn't always ignoring those configuration files on disk. And yeah, then thanks to the whole team, SIGUSA, Sparky, and Stack for bouncing ideas back and forth and writing the remaining part of the jailbreak, then for Poch2G and Synetic for the kernel bugs, and basically also a big thanks to Zorik for Substrate and the whole jailbreaking framework, and for Swagger, Parrot Geek, and Smackers and Ninja for testing a few things and keeping me motivated, and for Jonathan Levin for his books basically, because he bought a few awesome books about iOS and that got me into it 2 years ago. And yeah, and in the future I think exploiting kernel vulnerability without the cache functions and only in ROP really is a pain, and I probably won't do it again because I spent months with that. But yeah, the other big problem now is that with A12, so the newer iPhones, PAC, so pointer authentication, kills most of these types of exploits, because the problem there is that you would now need an ASLR bypass and the PAC bypass to get into return-oriented programming, and it's pretty unlikely to basically have both, because PAC bypasses are even really rare, and yeah, I only know about this one ASLR bypass, so yeah, you would have to get pretty lucky. Also, untethering gets progressively harder. Apple just fixed another good idea I had in iOS 13.1. Basically, the idea was to use printf with the format string format modifier %n to get a Turing complete machine, because printf with this modifier is basically Turing complete, and then use that to develop a PAC bypass basically and get into ROP. But now in iOS 13.1, I think Apple actually removed the %n modifier, so you can no longer do this. And yeah, so this idea is also gone. And yeah, in the end, I was able to complete my pipe dream, so I guess I will need a new one. So watch out, Apple. And that's Spice. Are there any questions?
Thank you, little Lilo, for his fantastic work. You, I suppose we're going to hear more from you in the future.
Maybe, let's
pretty
see.
Sure. Are there questions here in this audience? No one who wants to hire this guy now, right away. No one. Can you describe me what changed actually through times in these, you know, all the OS X, OES versions?
What they changed to make this
what,
possible?
You know, I told you, like, I started the tethering challenge actually at 5.1.
Well, they added a lot new mitigations and also obviously patched a few bugs, like for example those ASLR bypasses that Porch2G used in Corona got patched, and this one also now got patched by accident. But yeah, I mean, like, some bugs are still there. For example, the bug in Raccoon, the config browser bug, is still in O-Day, but yeah, I don't really care about it. And the kernel bugs got patched by Apple, but for example, the Synetic one, they also patched wrong by accident, and now it always leaked the struct, but I think they also fixed that now.
Your team, you're mentioning your team, you're working, you're not on your own, of course.
No.
And how are you structured? How are the roles divided? How is the...
Well, we are just like four people, so, and we have this group chat, and then we are just hanging out there and bouncing ideas back and forth and maybe working on some stuff.
And close contact with the Apple developers?
No, not at all.
Nothing?
No. No, I mean, I reported one bug to their bounty once, or like actually just to them, not their bounty, and that one got fixed and it was all fine, but yeah, for now I don't report bugs at the moment.
If you have time, you have time left now actually, you're looking for a new project, isn't it?
Yeah, and I might report some of those bugs in the meantime, but I mean, with the presentation they also know about them now, so they might fix them.
They will be listening now then, at least, probably, I hope.
Yeah.
Is there anyone who has really he was sitting on a question here. None of you. It's already noon, you know, noon past, so could be that none of you. You can ask them something. Maybe someone wants to help. You ask them something. Maybe they can help you out with certain challenges that are there.
Well, I don't really have a question either. I have my own research project now, where, like, I do stuff at the moment and look at other things. For example, the boot ROM exploit came out now, and so I started developing on the CheckRain team with them, and that's what I currently do basically.
You're great, man. Little Lilo, thank you. Give him a warm applause.